Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 24th of July, these are our main stories. Theresa May has addressed the Commons for the last time as Britain's Prime Minister before Boris Johnson takes office. And Robert Mueller, the former FBI director, is facing questions from Congress about his report into alleged Russian interference in the 2016 US election. Also in this podcast, Cuba rejects US scientists' claim that American diplomats suffered brain damage while working in Havana.
Cuba asked the United States to put an end to the use of this issue as a pretext to impose more measures of aggressions against the Cuban people.
And the practice is illegal, but women and girls in Nepal are still being banished from the family home during menstruation.
They were scared to sleep outside or in the chowpaddy huts because they knew of many girls who had actually died due to snake bites while sleeping outside their homes.
Imagine losing your job and your house on the same day. Well, that's what's happening to the outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May today as she hands over the reins of power to her successor, Boris Johnson, along with the keys to No. 10 Downing Street. At noon, Mrs. May faced her final Prime Minister's question session in the British Parliament. After 3 years in the job and watched by her husband, Philip, she said it had been a privilege to serve her country.
We are, as the Right Honourable Lady has said, living through extraordinary political times. This House of Commons is rightly at the centre of those events. And that's because of the vital link between every single member of this House and the communities, the Commons that we represent. That's the bedrock of our parliamentary democracy and of our liberty. And each one of us, wherever we sit, whatever we stand for, can take pride in that. And that duty to serve my constituents will remain my greatest motivation.
The leader of the main opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, had these words of praise for the Prime Minister.
I pay tribute to her sense of public duty. Public service should always be recognised. Being an MP, a minister, or indeed a Prime Minister is an honour that brings with it huge responsibility and huge pressures, both personally and, I'm sure, the Prime Minister and probably the whole House would agree, on those very closest to us, who often are not able to answer back for the criticisms made against them. So I hope, Mr. Speaker, that she has a marginally more relaxing time on the back benches and perhaps, like the Chancellor, even helping me to oppose the reckless plans of her successor.
Watching proceedings was our political reporter, Naomi Grimley.
Theresa May isn't a barnstorming personality, to be frank with you, but it was moving when she left the chamber. MPs on all sides stood up and started clapping her, and it was clear she was once again fighting back the tears. There was also a moment of humour earlier on from her, and she's not renowned for being a comedian, but when she was sparring with the main opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, she said to him, having accepted that my time as a leader is up, perhaps it's time for him to do the same. And that, of course, got lots of cheers from her own side. There was also tributes paid right around the political spectrum, including from one of the men who really helped bring her down. Jacob Rees-Mogg paid tribute to her public service and courtesy. But once again, lots of MPs in the chamber jeered at that moment because, obviously, if it wasn't for people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, Theresa May might have got her EU deal through Parliament.
Now, just looking at the practicalities, what actually happens to her now? What does she do? Have all of her belongings already been moved out of No. 10?
Yes, they have, to be blunt. We haven't seen, like in the old days, you used to see a removal van right outside the front door. We haven't got pictures of that, but we know that people have been moving furniture and possessions out of the back of Downing Street while Boris Johnson's have been going in. That process has been happening over the last few days. As for what happens now to Theresa May, she will go back to No. 10. She will make a short statement, this time to the nation, in the street before she leaves. She will then go to the palace and say goodbye to the Queen in a valedictory audience with her.
And Boris Johnson isn't Prime Minister just yet. What needs to happen now?
There will then be about an hour or so where Britain doesn't, strictly speaking, have a Prime Minister, because he needs to go to the palace too, where he will, in the parlance, kiss the hands of the Queen. He doesn't really kiss them. He sort of lightly brushes her hands and holds them to his lips. But that is the moment where the Queen has formally invited him to become the next Prime Minister.
That was Naomi Grimley. And of course, Boris Johnson will be Prime Minister by the time the next Global News podcast is recorded. I expect we'll probably mention it. Now, as we record this podcast, the former US Special Counsel Robert Mueller is answering questions in public before Congress for the first time since his report on Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election was published 3 months ago. That report said Russia did interfere in the election, but found no evidence of collusion. However, Mr. Mueller didn't exonerate Mr. Trump of obstructing justice. Here's Robert Mueller speaking to the House Judiciary Committee.
As described in Volume 2 of our report, we investigated a series of actions by the President towards the investigation. Based on Justice Department policy and principles of fairness, we decided we would not make a determination as to whether the President committed a crime. That was our decision then, and it remains our decision today.
The BBC's Gary O'Donoghue is watching events in Washington.
He spent quite a lot of this morning with one-word answers, pretty monosyllabic, saying, I refer you to my report, read the report, here it is, asking for repetition of questions. I mean, he's determined to say as little as possible, and set out at the beginning very clearly. He said, what I can say today is very limited. I'm not going to go into ongoing cases. I'm not going to speculate on the evidence. I'm under certain restrictions by the Department of Justice. Democrats, of course, determined to try and, in a sense, put a face to some of the quite extraordinary accusations and evidence that are found in the report itself. Republicans trying to emphasise the fact that he concluded that there was no conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia on the one hand, and that they couldn't come to a determination on whether or not the president obstructed justice.
That was Gary O'Donoghue. The Cuban government has rejected the findings of a study which was said to have found brain abnormalities in scans of 40 US diplomats who worked in Cuba. Several diplomats at the embassy in Havana complained of unexplained symptoms, including dizziness and hearing loss. And the Trump administration suggested that this was the result of an attack, perhaps involving some kind of sonic equipment. The issue was a key reason for the almost complete shutdown of the US embassy in Havana over the past 2 years, as US staff were sent home. A senior Cuban foreign ministry official in charge of U.S. affairs, Johanna Tablada, gave this statement at a news conference in Havana.
There is not a single evidence of any act in Cuba against their diplomats. Cuba asked the United States government to put an end to the manipulation and the use of this issue as a pretext to impose more and more measures of aggressions against the integrity of our country, its economy, and the Cuban people.
Cuba has always denied any involvement. From Havana, Will Grant reports.
The findings published in the Journal of American Medicine have only added to the mystery. In the study, scientists at the University of Pennsylvania took brain scans for 40 diplomats working in the US Embassy in Havana at the time of the alleged sonic attacks. In essence, they claim to have found brain abnormalities when comparing them to a control group of healthy volunteers. Specifically, the authors said the diplomats showed less white matter, which could affect the brain's ability to send messages, as well as other changes affecting auditory and spatial functions. The paper so frustrated the Cuban scientists that have been working on the supposed sonic attacks that they called a rare and impromptu press conference to refute them. The lead neuroscientist, Professor Michel Valdez Sosa, questioned the study's methodology and called the results inconclusive.
The changes in the brain images are very small, very diverse, and very diffuse. They do not correspond to a coherent explanation. The results do not have an internal coherence to make them easily interpretable.
He also argued that the University of Pennsylvania's study was based on fundamentally flawed science.
The differences between diplomats and controls, if it exists, could be due to the way the control group was selected. Any pre-existing disease in one group of diplomats that would be absent in the group of controls, or vice versa, could produce a difference in the images.
Now 2 years after the US diplomats left the island, this issue still matters to the Cuban government. The US State Department issued travel warnings about Cuba following the problem, which has affected tourism, and continues to refer to the incidents as attacks. The Cuban Foreign Ministry called on National Security Advisor John Bolton to stop using such language, saying that Washington was well aware that all diplomats, tourists and visitors were safe on Cuban soil. For its part, the United States says that its staff were harmed while in Cuba and blames the Cuban authorities for failing to prevent the incidents, especially after they were first alerted to them.
That was Will Grant in Havana. El Salvador has some of the strictest abortion laws in the world. Not only is there a total ban, but its laws see women and girls routinely imprisoned after enduring stillbirths and miscarriages. Last week, a 21-year-old woman, whose supporters say she had a stillbirth, faced the start of a retrial on charges of killing her baby. She has to prove that she didn't induce an abortion. Since 1998, terminations have been banned in all circumstances, including rape, incest, and a threat to the life of the mother. Women can be sentenced to a maximum of 50 years in jail. From the capital, San Salvador, Orla Guerin sent this report.
We've come to a bungalow in San Salvador, and this is a home for women who have been released from prison. I'm in the back garden with Teodora Vasquez, who's 35. Teodora spent almost 11 years in prison. She's one of many women here who have been convicted under the country's anti-abortion legislation. When Teodora was sent to prison, she was already a mother of a 3-year-old son. She missed his entire childhood. Teodora, can you tell me what happened?
En el 2007, yo estaba embarazada.
It was the July of 2007. I was heavily pregnant. I was working in the canteen of a school and I started to experience intense pain. I was alone. I called 911, but no one turned up. Unfortunately, I passed out as soon as I felt something fall out of my body. When I regained consciousness, I was surrounded by police officers and they were asking me why I had killed my baby. I had no idea why they were accusing me of this.
Me preguntaron que por qué había matado a mi bebé.
When Teodora was released last year, her sentence was commuted. She says she was jailed for a crime she did not commit. Some women and girls in El Salvador do seek terminations, which have to be performed in secret. Well, there is a network of doctors who carry out abortions here, in spite of the risks, both for the women and for themselves. The doctors could lose their medical licences. They could be jailed for up to 8 years. We've come to the outskirts of the city now to meet one of these doctors. He's agreed to speak to us, but he doesn't want us to use his name. He says he's doing this because there are so many women who come to him in desperate need of help. The doctor told us that about a third of his patients have miscarried, but are afraid to go to hospital in case staff call the police. His words are being spoken by an actor.
There is so much sexual violence here. It affects almost 60% of my patients. Many are abused by gang members. And I see minors raped by a brother, an uncle, a father. I am frustrated as a Salvadoran and a doctor that the victims are being punished by the law.
It's poor women who suffer most under the abortion ban, according to human rights groups, because they don't have access to education, health care or legal help. 16 women remain behind bars. Teodora is fighting hard to free them, but like many campaigners here, she's not expecting any quick reform of the law.
That was Orla Guerin. Still to come in this podcast.
Let's go now!
Yes, you heard that mashup right. A male breakdancer from Poland is to replace a leading lady at Britain's prestigious Glyndebourne Opera. Nearly 9 tons of elephant ivory and 12 tons of pangolin scales have been intercepted in Singapore. Officials say the 3 shipping containers, labelled as timber, were en route to Vietnam from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Paul de Ornelas is chief wildlife advisor for the environmental group WWF UK.
Obviously, if we're seeing tons of ivory, tons of pangolin scales being shipped across the globe, that indicates that there is organised criminal networks active. At the same time, we do have to give credit to the Singaporean authorities. They've intercepted this shipment. And this is not the first time this has happened in Singapore. Over the last 12 to 18 months, we've seen them seize somewhere in the region of 40 tons of pangolin scales. So whilst that is a testament to their efforts to target traffickers, it does indicate that this is an ongoing pressure that these species are facing. Primarily, pangolin scales are used in Chinese traditional medicine. They're also occasionally used in ornaments and things like that, but primarily for traditional use. Although the shipment was sourced from or came from the DRC, it's quite possible that the ivory contained within it, that the pangolins that were harvested, came from other parts of Africa. And we've seen evidence of trafficking networks that cover basically much of West and Central Africa. They may pass out from the DRC, they may pass out from Nigeria, but often the elephants or the pangolins are killed and taken from the wild elsewhere.
Paul de Ornelas from the WWF UK. Last August, in Nepal, a law was introduced banning chaupaddy. That's a practice that sees women and girls who are menstruating excluded from the family home and made to sleep in outbuildings. It was outlawed after a number of deaths. Those who break the law are supposed to be subject to fines or imprisonment, but new research has found that in reality, very little has changed. Dr. Mel Channon is lecturer in social policy at the University of Bath in England.
We found that 3/4 of girls in the region we went to were still practicing chaupaddy, even though it has been illegal for nearly a year now. And they were telling us things like how they were scared to sleep outside or in the chaupaddy huts because they knew of many girls who had actually died due to snake bites while sleeping outside their homes. There are a range of different places where they can sleep. There are specific chaupaddy huts, but those are more rare nowadays, and we even heard of the police destroying some of them. But what happens when these specific chaupaddy huts don't exist is that girls then end up sleeping either outside or in cow sheds, so actually on the floor with the animal dung. The girls that we talked to said things like they felt heartbroken and they felt disgusted and that they wished that they were born a boy so they didn't have to do these things. Even though they knew that they wouldn't be punished by God or cause any ill fortune by not practicing chaupaddy, the elders in their community, so their grandparents, religious leaders, traditional healers, community leaders, they really believed that misfortune would befall people if the girls didn't practice chaupaddy, and that they said they couldn't fight against that. They couldn't teach them. And they said that what they needed potentially was outsiders to come in and teach people. But then they also said that when outsiders had come in and told them about the law and told them that they shouldn't be doing this, then everyone politely nodded and said, yes, of course we shouldn't be doing this. And then the day after it would just go back to normal. So it's a really tricky situation because it's so deeply embedded within the culture.
That was Dr. Mel Channon. The World Health Organization recently declared the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo a public health emergency of international concern. As well as raising the profile of the crisis, that was designed to increase the flow of resources to tackle the outbreak. But there are concerns that funding that might be available to save lives isn't reaching the people in need. Specifically, money is yet to be released from the Pandemic Emergency Financing Facility, or PEF, a financial instrument that was created to ensure that emergency funding is available to tackle disasters. The Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Laurie Garrett spoke to the BBC's Shaima Khalil about the complexities of funding the Ebola response.
The Ebola response has been running on a deficit for quite some time, millions and millions of dollars behind its needs level. And WHO has been robbing other programs in its Geneva headquarters to finance its own operations on the ground. The latest call for funding is a tripling of the current budget, but the current budget was never even met. So the needs level is in excess of $300 million.
Tell us about the Pandemic Emergency Financing Facility, or the PEF. How is it supposed to operate?
It's kind of like a strange combination of some money donated and a lot of money in hedge funds and insurance bond issuances. And there's actually several sort of sub-funds under this large PEF fund. Each is designated to be only used for certain narrow list of diseases. So theoretically available is about $250,000 for Ebola. And yet it's not been triggered. They've not released the funds for this epidemic. And, you know, part of the reason is how it was set up. It's designed so that investors would put their money in, hedging against there being an actual epidemic. And they would gamble with their money that 5 years would elapse without such an epidemic. And then they would earn interest off their investment better than the standard bond rating issuances available for, say, taking out a London bond, a city bond.
But hang on, that means that the interests of the investors and the interests of those who need the money were in an epidemic area are at odds, because it would be good for the investors if there is no epidemic. So I would imagine people are reluctant to call something out.
You are exactly right. There is a real conflict of interest here.
You know, when the World Health Organization declared Ebola a public health emergency of international concern, the immediate response from people who we spoke to in terms of what that means is it will mean release of funds. It will mean more support. It will mean more resources. What you're saying is that's not necessarily the case.
It absolutely is not necessarily the case.
As it stands, what is the urgent need at the moment for the World Bank to release the funds to?
First of all, we're running out of vaccine, and the manufacturer of the primary vaccine, Merck, needs to rev up its own production, get a whole new facility up and running in order to get sufficient supplies to the ground. Secondly, it costs a lot of money just to move personnel, equipment, supplies, and expertise in and out of this relatively remote area. You can't simply fly in as if you were flying to, say, Nairobi. You must have a series of special flights. And once you get to the ground, you've got to have people greeting you with special vehicles and driving terribly carefully and knowing in detail which roads are controlled by which armies on any given day. It's like trying to cure disease in the middle of the bombings of Syria.
That was Laurie Garrett. There's evidence that vast swathes of the Arctic are suffering from unprecedented wildfires. New satellite images show that north of the Arctic Circle there are enormous wildfires which are wreaking ecological destruction on a colossal scale. It comes after the world's hottest June on record, which has been followed by a devastating heatwave in the US, with Europe suffering the same treatment this week. One man who has been following these fires closely is Dr. Mark Parrington, senior scientist at the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecast.
I first noticed there was a number of fires burning in the Arctic Circle around the 9th or 10th of June this year. I monitor global wildfire activity, so the location and the intensity most days, and those ones in the Arctic really stood out, particularly in the Siberian part of the Arctic. So we use satellite measurements of the biotemperature, if you like, and the intensity. And from that, we can estimate emissions of particulates and pollutants and greenhouse gases. And if we estimate the emissions of carbon dioxide from these fires, we're estimating that these may be twice the average of the last 16 years when we look at our data. I work at the European Weather Centre, and we run two Copernicus environmental services, and one of those is the atmosphere monitoring, which is the service in which we have the fire data. But we also do a climate monitoring service, and we look at the monthly changes in the climate relative to an average of 1981 to 2010. And what really stands out for the Siberian Siberian Arctic during June of 2019 was a much higher temperature anomaly and a much drier conditions. And so what clearly is happening is that the environmental conditions are right for when there's been an ignition, either through lightning or through possibly self-combustion, that these fires are then taking hold and persisting for a long period of time.
That was Dr. Mark Parrington. A new star will be appearing next month at one of Britain's most prestigious classical music venues. The Glyndebourne Opera is staging a production of Handel's Rinaldo, but has had to search for a replacement after losing its leading lady. Not many people would have expected a 28-year-old male breakdancer from Poland to step in, but that is exactly what will happen. Jakub Józef Orliński will be taking to the stage. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones reports.
Let's go now!
He's a man of many talents. A breakdancer, Jakub Józef Orliński found fame on social media and his videos have been viewed millions of times. He's also worked as a model. But it's his voice which will be the focus when he makes his debut at Glyndebourne. When the female singer who was originally cast as Rinaldo unexpectedly withdrew, Orliński was asked to step up from a minor role to take the lead. The part can either be performed by a female mezzo-soprano or a male countertenor, and Orliński was a natural fit. But he won't be breakdancing in the opera. Glyndebourne says handstands and spinning upside down are not recommended on stage.
And that report was by Rebecca Jones. That's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Hello, I'm Marnie Chesterton, and I present the Crowd Science podcast from the BBC World Service. Crowd Science is a podcast that has the sweet remit of taking our listeners' questions about anything scientific and trying to answer them with the help of scientists from around the world. We get everything from is there life after death and what's beyond the limits of the universe to what's inside the dust in my vacuum cleaner. Crowd Science goes to wherever the cutting-edge research is taking place. I've been put on a starvation diet. I've gargled with millions of viruses. I've had to run alongside marathon runners in the dark in almost horizontal rain during a hurricane in Greece. But that's part of the show. We try and get to where people are doing things, where people are trialing things, and you see the science taking place before your eyes. That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. Just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.